From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, suicide blast kills dozens in Afghanistan. Hong Kong starts controversial election reform process. Cambodia judicial laws of deep concern, say legal experts. These stories and more on this Wednesday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. Afghan officials say a suicide car bomb has killed more than 40 people in eastern Afghanistan. Earlier reports said 89 were killed. Tuesday's attack took place in a region that borders Pakistan. Ayaz Ghul has more from Islamabad.
Authorities in the Afghan province of Paktika say almost all the victims of Tuesday's suicide blast are civilians and fear the death toll may rise. A presidential statement says children were also among those killed when a bomber detonated his explosives-packed car in a crowded market in Urgan district. The district governor, Mohammad Reza Kharoti, told VOA that rescue workers were still trying to retrieve bodies and transport the wounded to local hospitals. The governor says the massive explosion destroyed around 50 shops on both sides of the road, while up to 20 vehicles were also damaged. He added that many of the victims were buried under the rubble. Defense Ministry spokesman Mohammad Zahir Azimi says the military is providing helicopters and ambulances to transport those seriously injured to the provincial capital, Sharan. The Afghan Taliban denied involvement in the attack. The insurgent group spokesman Zabiullah Mujahid issued a statement saying its mujahideen were not behind Tuesday's car bombing because such attacks do not bring any benefit to them. The attack happened hours after a roadside bomb in the Afghan capital killed two employees of President Hamid Karzai's media office. Police say five people were wounded, with the Taliban claiming responsibility for the blast. Afghanistan has seen a rise in insurgent violence at a time when international troops are reducing their presence in the country to complete their withdrawal by the end of this year. The United Nations says that escalation in hostilities in Afghanistan has pushed up civilian deaths and injuries by a quarter in the first 6 months of 2014. The UN mission in Kabul recently reported a direct correlation in some areas between the closures of foreign military bases and a rise in civilian casualties. Paktika province, the site of Tuesday's deadly blast, borders Pakistan's North Waziristan tribal district, where a full-blown military offensive against militant hideouts is underway. The Waziristan territory is a known hub of the Pakistani Taliban and is notorious for harboring fighters of the Afghan Taliban insurgency as well as the Al-Qaeda-linked Haqqani network. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai says he has reluctantly accepted a U.S.-mediated deal to audit all the votes from the country's presidential runoff election following allegations of fraud during the voting process. VOA's Arup Pandey has more from Washington.
In an exclusive interview with VOA's Afghan service, President Karzai said he did not welcome the agreement, but accepted it as a bitter pill due to the current political conditions in Afghanistan.
I accepted it because I wanted to get past the stage very quickly, because the elections have already taken a lot of time in this country. No country in the world has such a lengthy electoral process, and this must be corrected as well. And the Afghan people are waiting very much, very impatiently, to have their new president.
Tensions were high in the country after presidential candidates Abdullah Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani both claimed victory in the June 14th runoff to replace Mr. Karzai. Former Afghan Foreign Minister Abdullah dismissed the runoff results that put Ghani ahead by 1 million votes as tainted with irregularities. He accused Ghani, election authorities, and President Karzai of colluding against him to rig the vote. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry traveled to Kabul and held hours of intense negotiations with Ghani and Abdullah on July 12th, and both candidates agreed to a UN-supervised audit of the 8 million ballots. According to the deal, the new president will immediately form a government of national unity. A senior U.S. official said, whatever the outcome of the election audit, the candidate who does not emerge as winner will play a formal role in the new Afghan government. President Karzai told VOA he welcomed the idea of a national unity government, saying all Afghan people should see themselves in their government. But he was more cautious about reports the candidates agreed to create a parliamentary democracy.
In order for Afghanistan to have a parliamentary form of government, we must, before that, make sure that we have strong institutions. The civil services of the country must be entirely and totally apolitical and protected by law.
Mr. Karzai said institutions like the military and judiciary should also be protected from political intervention. He said Afghanistan still needs time to strengthen these institutions in order to move from a presidential to parliamentary system. As Afghanistan undergoes this transition and his decade in office nears its end, Mr. Karzai told VOA that whatever the outcome, he will stand firmly behind the next leader of Afghanistan.
If ever the next Afghan president or the next government would ask me for advice, I would humbly come and provide that advice. I would be trying my best to be a factor of help and assistance and stability.
And when VOA asked if Mr. Karzai could go back and change one aspect of his presidency, he declined to reveal the, quote, massive change he would make, noting that he is still president of Afghanistan and must choose his words cautiously. Arup Pandey, VOA News, Washington.
Later on Daybreak Asia, an education update on a U.S.-Indonesia partnership. The Hong Kong government has issued a document formally asking Beijing to allow election reform. The paper, submitted on Tuesday to the Standing Committee of China's legislature, comes after months of intense debate over Beijing's role in the territory's future elections. Rebecca Valley has more from Hong Kong.
The report is the first formal step towards universal suffrage in the former British colony and the outcome of 5 months of government consultation with organizations and individuals in Hong Kong. Chief Executive Long Chung-ing said the government had received 124,700 written submissions and that the reform will be an important milestone of the democratic development of Hong Kong's political system.
Today is a historic moment in the constitutional development of Hong Kong. We will be able to take a big stride forward in the democratic development of Hong Kong if we are willing to forge consensus as much as we can and leave behind our differences in a rational and pragmatic manner on the remaining work.
Hong Kong's chief executive is now elected by a committee of 1,200 people, largely representing Beijing's interests. The reform plan, which will ultimately need approval from Beijing, is intended to give the former British colony a one-man, one-vote type of democracy, a unique setup for a region under Chinese rule. But the details on who will be eligible for top office has created a split between Democrats in Hong Kong and the central authorities in Beijing. Tuesday's document is unlikely to calm the spirits. It presented two controversial topics as mainstream opinions, including the provision that candidates to the chief executive job should love the country and be patriotic, and that they should be picked by a nominating committee and not more directly by the public. Activists have been calling for a legal framework that allows more independence in picking candidates, and such a plan was endorsed by 800,000 Hong Kongers in an unofficial referendum earlier this year. The paper mentions such a setup called civic nomination and says there are still considerable views that it should be included in the plan. Michael Davis is a professor of law at Hong Kong University.
So civil nominations is described and repeated at several points, but always as a kind of alternative view to something that's presented first, typically as a more mainstream view.
Beijing has repeatedly ruled out the possibility of direct selection of candidates by the public, insisting that such a provision does not comply with Hong Kong's constitution or basic law. In a recent white paper that enraged the territory's pro-democracy camp, Beijing stated that any autonomy the city enjoys is dependent upon authorization by the central government. Such statements have fueled public mistrust of Beijing's intentions, says Davis, and run counter to the Sino-British agreement, which granted Hong Kong with a high degree of autonomy.
with the treaty now is completely dismissed as almost of no significance, but rather all of this is takes its authority from China, and China can interpret it any way it wants. It even indicates in there that China is the guardian of the rule of law. That's a very different picture than what was presented to Hong Kong when the Sino-British Joint Declaration was sold to Hong Kong.
Occupy Central, the group behind the unofficial referendum that endorsed civic nomination, has threatened to occupy downtown Hong Kong should the reform plan that is ultimately adopted fails to meet international standards of democracy. For VOA News, this is Rebecca Valli in Hong Kong.
China is increasingly asserting its influence economically and militarily throughout Asia, but its impact can also be felt further through foreign aid and investment, especially in Africa. Shannon Van Sant has more from Beijing.
Chinese officials in recent months have been promoting the establishment of two new so-called Silk Roads, one a land-based road and another a maritime trade route that authorities hope will further unite China economically with other parts of the world. Earlier this summer, China hosted a Silk Road Economic Belt Media Cooperation Forum in Beijing, which state media said was intended to rejuvenate the Silk Road by encouraging inter-regional development. The original Silk Road was a series of ancient trade routes that linked the major economies of Asia to trading partners in Europe and the Mediterranean. Alice Ekman is a research fellow for China at the French Institute of International Relations.
We have seen repetition or an insistence on the concept of maritime Silk Road and a Silk Road economic belt that may announce development of a specific strategy or at least an emphasis on constructive new axes that may guide this regional policy.
She says the strategy is not a new one, but China has raised establishing Silk Road economic belts to a new level of priority.
So why I think this topic is of relevance and this research question is of relevance is because, first of all, the region itself is officially presented as a priority under Xi, even more than under Hu Jintao.
China is rebranding the ancient trade routes to boost trade ties and infrastructure throughout the region. As envisioned by Chinese officials, the new land-based Silk Road would go through Central Asia to northern Iran and through Iraq, Syria, and Turkey, ending in Europe. The maritime Silk Road would go through the Malacca Strait to India, Kenya, and then north around the Horn of Africa through the Mediterranean before meeting the land-based Silk Road in Venice. China's ancient leaders took extensive steps to protect their trade routes and ensure commerce ran smoothly, and observers say the new routes are no different. Ekman says China is increasingly asserting itself along the trade routes through hard moves, such as territorial disputes in the South China Seas, and soft moves, such as increased aid to countries in Africa. Stephen Sabe of the UN Development Program says China's international aid is increasingly tackling problems at a grassroots level through providing employment opportunities as opposed to just food or improved infrastructure.
So I think what we've seen is a lot of governments gradually saying, the things you've done have been really helpful, you know, setting up the agricultural training centres or bringing out the doctors, building whatever it was, the government buildings, etc. But we'd now like you to be doing things which have a more direct impact on the grassroots, on poverty reduction at the grassroots. And so that message is coming through. And now the question, I think, for our Chinese counterparts is not whether to do that, it's how.
China is also forming free trade agreements and promoting greater use of its currency in some countries along these trade routes. The increase in ties between China and these countries will not only boost trade, but also increase China's energy security. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Beijing.
You're listening to Daybreak Asia. Thanks for including us in the start of your day. International legal experts are expressing deep concern over proposed changes to Cambodia's legal system that critics say hand over too much power to the executive. At a meeting in Phnom Penh Tuesday, the group recommended the three judicial reform laws should be returned to Parliament for further discussion. The proposed legislation is currently with Cambodia's king awaiting his signature to become law. Robert Carmichael reports from Phnom Penh.
The UN Special Rapporteur on the Independence of Judges and Lawyers, Gabriella Knauel, told attendees at Tuesday's meeting that the three laws on judicial reform undermine the principle of the separation of powers and called on Cambodia's constitutional monarch not to sign them and to send them back to Parliament to ensure public input.
My request is in the sense that these laws, if they are enacted, there is a high level of chance that a lot of amendments should be done. So it's a kind of anticipation. Instead of signing this law, he could send these laws again to the Parliament and restart the process with open debate, as the government has done in many different kinds of laws in Cambodia.
The three draft judicial reform laws recently flew through Parliament, the Senate and the scrutiny of the Constitutional Council before ending up on the desk of the King. Once he signs them, they will become law. But the law's numerous critics say they are fundamentally flawed. They say they not only run counter to Cambodia's constitution, which guarantees the independence of the judiciary, they also conflict with Cambodia's commitments to an independent judiciary as enshrined in legal instruments such as the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Knauel, a Brazilian judge who has been the UN Special Rapporteur since 2009, explains that the three laws can have a big impact on the Cambodian legal system.
They deal with the structure of the court, how it works, how it should function, what are the borderlines between the powers, what kind of guarantees the beneficiaries of the justice system should have. This kind of law regulates the appointment process, the transfer, suspension, disciplinary proceedings against judges. It deals with matters related to enhancing transparency, accountability of the judicial system. It defines and makes clear what's the role of the judge and the prosecutors in order to avoid confusion on the roles of each one.
The key failing is that they hand significant power to the executive, not least to the Minister of Justice and senior ministry staff, giving them wide-ranging powers in such key areas as budgets, complaints, promotions, and the removal or punishment of judges and prosecutors. In short, the laws would provide the executive a free hand to interfere in the judiciary. Nadia Hardman is the program lawyer at the Human Rights Institute of the International Bar Association, or IBA, a British-based non-profit that supports the independence of the judiciary. The IBA, which hosted Tuesday's news conference, expressed its, quote, deep concern over controversial judicial reforms, which could provide an excessive transfer of power from the judiciary to the executive, end quote. Hardman says codifying executive control into primary legislation over the judiciary creates a series of documents that could, in theory, be used to enact future abuses. Those problems, she adds, are eminently avoidable.
If you're going to formalise what goes on at a judicial level, especially in this day and age when there are so many best practice standards, there are so many guidelines, there are so many initiatives at the UN and regional level, countries have model legislation to draw upon, and at the moment you really should be relying on those best practice standards.
For its part, the Cambodian government says it is satisfied with the provisions of the laws. Robert Carmichael for VOA News, Phnom Penh.
In June 2010, President Barack Obama and Indonesian President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono announced a higher education partnership in which the United States and Indonesia would commit to provide world-class university educations and to help double the number of American and Indonesian students who study in each other's country. Just over 4 years later, we wanted to find out how the program was faring. Daybreak Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Terry Bogalke, Director of Education and Higher Educational Policy at the East-West Center in Honolulu. Dr. Bogalke worked as a program officer with the Ford Foundation in Jakarta, where he was responsible for educational program development, culture, social sciences, and human rights.
Over the last 3 to 4 years, I think that we can see some quite tangible results, although this is a long road. We can see that probably there have been about 50 to 60 new types of relationships developed between higher education institutions, the universities and colleges in the U.S., and and those in Indonesia, along with some non-educational institutions too, some research institutions and the like in Indonesia that are partnering with some of our universities. We can see on the Indonesian side, we can see an increase over that time of probably something like 15 to 20% of more students studying in the United States. And going the other direction, it's more dramatic, though the number of Americans studying in Indonesia beginning about, say, 4 years ago was really very small. It had fallen down below 100 people a year who were studying there. And now it's up, getting close to 700 people a year, 800 people a year. And that's, I think we're going to see quite dramatic growth on that side as well.
Why is Indonesia so important when it comes to educational agreements?
Well, Indonesia and the U.S. are two of the largest democracies in the world. They have two of the largest populations in the world. They're both very influential countries. And I think Indonesia knows the United States in many respects better than Americans know Indonesia. And so I think part of this is it works both ways. On the one hand, I think that for Indonesians, I think they're the importance of coming here, of studying here, of building these kinds of relationships is important for really having a more nuanced and more, I think, more accurate picture of the tremendous diversity of this country, the complexity of the country, the excitement of what's going on here that really, I think, helps to balance some of the more sensational kinds of coverage that happens sometimes in Indonesia about what's going on in the U.S. and vice versa. I think the picture that people in the U.S. have of Indonesia, to the extent that Indonesia is covered in the U.S. press, tends to be around more sensational kinds of events. And in fact, there's so much exciting that's going on in Indonesia. Indonesia is such it's a rapidly growing economy, about the 14th largest economy in the world at this point, very influential player within the ASEAN region, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. So it's very important to be developing that relationship.
Where do you see this relationship going from where it now stands?
I see these relationships growing. I think there's, on the Indonesian side, a recognition that to be able to really internationalize those institutions, they need to do more by using English language for teaching purposes. They're doing that within their own institutions for some of their degree programs. Many institutions are also starting special courses that are taught in English about Indonesia, but are really targeted at international students. And that's definitely an important way to build that relationship on the Indonesian side.
Terry Bogalke, Director of Education and Higher Educational Policy at the East-West Center in Honolulu. He was speaking with Daybreak Asia's Ira Melman. Stay right where you are. The latest world news is coming your way next with Steve Norman and International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
For listeners in China, there's a new Chinese language iPhone application from VOA. Simply go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA space Chinese.